From WBUR Boston, I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Amtrak faces a rough ride on the rails. The Bush administration wants to end its more than $1 billion annual subsidy. Its 20 Acela trains are out of service until this summer. And Amtrak still struggles with rundown trains, rickety tracks, constant delays. It does not cover its own operating costs, and it has had no money to upgrade its trains or fix major problems with its rails. A massive reorganization, President Bush style, would likely mean an end to passenger rail service in many parts of the country, especially in America's heartland. The other option, maybe much less likely, is that Congress springs for much larger subsidies to put new life into the rail system. Tonight on Point, Amtrak and the future of passenger rail service in America. We begin tonight with a look at the latest twists in the Amtrak story. Michael Dresser is transportation reporter for the Baltimore Sun. I asked him how Amtrak is proposing to save itself.
With proposing a series of measures that are a bit more closely aligned with the proposals of the Bush administration, it has accepted the notion that there should be competition in the rail passenger industry. It has gone along to some degree with the administration's desire to move a lot of the responsibility for the rail passenger system to the states, and also the money, although it is proposing a split that is more along the line with the 80-20 you typically see with highways and airports.
80% federal, 20% state?
Correct, rather than the 50-50 that the Bush administration has floated.
Any reaction from the states to that idea that they cough up 20%?
I have not heard that so far. I think a lot of these organizations are studying this, trying to form a consensus. I know that the transportation secretary of my state, Maryland, he's a Republican, and he's taking a cautious look at it, saying that if the business model works, the money will be there. If the business model isn't a good one, then the money won't be there.
Now, this is Amtrak's idea. What's the Bush administration's proposal?
Well, the Bush administration has essentially zeroed out Amtrak in its budget this year and has kind of demanded immediate sweeping changes in its structure, and it's really done this largely as a pressure mechanism. It's saying no money till we see reform, and it wants to go farther than the Amtrak board, which is all appointed by Bush, but the administration's proposal would simply get Amtrak out of the infrastructure business entirely and have it be simply an operator.
Speaking of pressure mechanisms, taking more than $1 billion in subsidies off the table in one fell swoop would be one way of ratcheting up the pressure. How do the politicians feel? I gather even some Republicans don't think this is much of an idea.
Well, this is not a party line issue by any means. This is geography. And if you want to predict how the senators feel about it, you probably want to get a map of Amtrak's routes. Nobody, Republican or Democrat, wants to lose service to the home folks. So at yesterday's hearing, you were getting a very hostile reaction to the administration's proposal from conservative Republicans as Conrad Burns of Montana and Trent Lott of Mississippi.
Right. Places where they need the public service.
Places where they like having the trains come through. And maybe they aren't profitable, but their constituents still like to take trains.
Now, Amtrak obviously is not a profitable business at the moment. How soon do they need to settle this before the trains literally stop running?
Well, you know, these things have a way of limping along. I mean, there are some signs that this problem with the high-speed Acela cars could bring Amtrak to the point of a cash crunch toward the end of the fiscal year.
These are the high-speed trains they've had to suspend for the next couple
right.
of months.
But I suspect that they will find a way to string this out and negotiate, because I don't see that there's a political win for anybody in having a service shut down. I mean, that's not exactly a proud boast to take to the voters in the congressional elections.
We were the last hurrah for trains.
Well, you know, I think the notion that we are the guys who killed Amtrak, this would play only among a very narrow segment of, you know, hardcore libertarian conservatives, but among the general population, I can't see it being a winner.
Michael, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're quite welcome.
Michael Dresser is transportation reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He spoke with me from Baltimore. We're talking tonight about the future of Amtrak and of passenger rail service in the United States. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to give up on train travel? Maybe just to give up on Amtrak's version? Or do you want your tax dollars going to save passenger rail service? You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Larchmont, New York, is Elliot Sklar. He is professor of urban planning and public affairs at Columbia University and the author of Amtrak Privatization, The Route to Failure. Welcome.
Thank you.
Professor, Amtrak would seem to be in a bit of a mess. What's going wrong here?
Well, I think the mess is, if you just look at the moment, you see the mess, but you have to put it into its historic context. The notion that Amtrak is losing money now and that it'll make money at some point is not grounded in reality. The simple fact is that passenger rail service is not a profitable business. Indeed, most passenger transportation is iffy at best. All we have to do is look at the history of our airlines, and all we have to do is look at the history of rail service in this country. The reason Amtrak is in the public realm now is because it didn't work as a private service. Some would argue that, well, it's a white elephant, but the fact is that all over Europe, high-speed rail is in fact a major public service, and trains run at speeds close to 200 miles an hour. You could get from Boston to Washington with existing technology, if the track beds were right, in 3 hours. Atlanta would be 4 hours from Chicago at those kinds of speeds. The real issue is, are we going to invest in a national public service at a time when oil is forecast to go to $105 a barrel, at a time when 80% of trips between intercity trips are under 500 miles? Are we going to take a major piece of our national infrastructure and just dump it? That seems to me is the central issue in this.
It's kind of a tough argument to make in this climate, though, isn't it? Because you're talking about high-speed trains that would need a complete change in the infrastructure. You can't run trains 200 miles an hour on the track that we have now, can you?
That's for sure. No, you can't. But it seems to me the issue here isn't whether we're going to save this tottering system. The issue is whether we're going to have an economy that's competitive in the world, that's energy efficient. We're going to have a transportation service from center city to center city in our major metropolitan areas, or whether we're going to, in fact, find ourselves further and further behind the eight ball because we do absolutely nothing to make our transportation system efficient. And our system is railroads, it's airlines, and it's highways. And the problem here is that we single out Amtrak and we talk about it needing a subsidy. Well, highways are subsidized at about over $20 billion. A couple of years ago, I haven't looked at the most recent number, $24 billion a year in highway subsidy aid went out from the government. Since from the time Amtrak first came into the public sector, 30-odd years ago, they spent a little bit over $20 billion. It's about $1 billion a year now that they're spending on it. In the 5 years from 1997 to 2002, they spent around $5.7 million. In 2001 alone, after 9/11, the airline industries were given $5 billion. So why we single out Amtrak and say it needs subsidy when, in fact, the whole transportation system is publicly subsidized, of course, it's a public service, It's clearly an ideological issue. It has nothing to do with economics.
Well, Professor Sklar, isn't part of the argument that a lot more people fly and a lot more people drive?
Well, if you put more subsidy into highways and you starve rail, and you put more subsidies into airlines and you starve rail, it's a no-brainer what people are going to do, isn't it?
Well, this is kind of a chicken and egg argument, isn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah. But the point is that if we want to talk about the economics of a reality-based economics of transportation, of investment in the country, of productivity, that's one thing. If we take Amtrak out, you know, take the chicken and egg out, just take the one piece of it, you can end up you could end up doing this with almost any piece of the transportation infrastructure in this country and transportation service.
Well, does Amtrak get off scot-free here in this discussion of what the problem is? Because when we look at the Acela trains, which have been sidelined yet again, this time for brake problems, mm-hmm. how much blame do we put with Acela's management for their inability to run the rail service?
Well, I'm not privy to it, but clearly something screwed up, and you certainly can talk about the management. If we want to talk about management, then let's talk about how we fix the management of the system. I'm willing to have that discussion, but that's not what the national discussion is about, is it?
Well, the Bush administration seems to think that making it private will make it better managed.
Well, it was private, and it was very badly managed, wasn't it?
I don't know. How long? Yeah. How far back are we going?
Well, go back. Guess all you have to do is go back to 1970. The problem is that there's nothing magic about public or private management. The issue is if you're going to have public subsidy and public regulation, you've got to make it work. And the fact that they can make it work in Europe, and that there are lots of different ways of doing this, it indicates to me that we're not looking at the problem. We're looking at an ideological solution here.
Okay, Professor Sklar, stay with us. We're going to take a pause here. We're talking tonight about the future of passenger rail service in America. You can join the conversation. Nostalgia aside, what will America lose? What will you lose if Amtrak goes? Are you an Amtrak enthusiast, or did you give up on it long ago? You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Amtrak's future and what passenger rail service in America should be like in 2005 and beyond. You can join the talk. Does Amtrak deserve a new lease on life, do you think? If the government pours billions into the airline industry, why not a little more money for Amtrak? Or do you care more about planes than trains? You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're speaking with Elliot Sklar, professor of urban planning and public affairs at Columbia. And joining me now from Seattle, Washington, is Thomas Till. He's the former executive director of the Amtrak Reform Council. In the Reagan administration, he was deputy federal railroad administrator. He's currently managing director of the Discovery Institute, a free market think tank. Welcome, Mr. Till.
How do you do?
Do you think a passenger rail service has to make a profit or die?
No, I don't think any of the proposals that are out there today are really about what people are running around calling privatization without understanding what privatization is. Privatization means that you take something and you simply put it in the marketplace and you let it sink or swim. I don't believe there are any proposals out there, whether they're in the administration's or Amtrak's or anybody else's, that are on the table before the Congress right now that really talk about privatization. They talk about commercialization because what they want to do is separate the governmental functions of Amtrak from the commercial functions of Amtrak and then bring in, under contract, private firms to carry out those commercial functions. By doing that, and Mr. Sklar has talked about Britain, or about Europe and their trains, well, what's happened in Britain since 1996 when they privatized is that by bringing in private operators, they've raised their ridership by 45%. Now, that's not just the little bit that Amtrak's talking about over the last 5 or 7 years of raising it from around 20 to around 25. This is raising it from 760 million passengers a year to over 1,100 million passengers a year.
Yes, but they've also raised the government subsidy. It costs the government more to do that.
That's right, but it's not the government subsidy is not going to the train operators. The government subsidy, because when they split the infrastructure when they separated it from the train operations, what they found out was that this great old government company, British Rail, didn't have a clue about what kind of condition its infrastructure was in, and just as the case with Amtrak in the Northeast Corridor, it wasn't able to get the money from the government to fix up its infrastructure, even if it knew what kind of condition it's in.
Sorry, Professor Sklar, if I can just get my head's starting to swim. I knew this was going to happen.
All right.
Mr. Till, the idea presumably is that you would leave Amtrak in charge of what it's good at and bring in private companies to do what they do best. Walk me through that.
I think that I'm sorry.
Are you going to answer that?
I can't. I'm not going to answer that, of course.
Okay.
But the situation is this: you have a structure called the National Railroad Passenger Corporation, and that corporation holds a government franchise that was negotiated in the deal that created Amtrak and took the burden of passenger rail, which was failing miserably and losing $500 million a year back in 1970, off the backs of the freight railroads. All right, so what did they do? They created this train operating company that was going to operate passenger trains all over the country, and it began operations in 1971. In 1976, after $60 million worth of federal planning effort, they actually launched a new corporation out of the wreck of the Penn Central and the other bankrupt railroads in the northeastern United States and called it Conrail, Consolidated Rail Corporation. But Conrail didn't want the tracks, the very expensive tracks and tunnels and electrification between Washington, D.C. and Boston, Massachusetts. It was primarily a passenger railroad. So they handed it over to Amtrak, which was like taking a three-year-old kid and hanging a millstone around its neck. It didn't have the capability to manage it. It didn't have, couldn't get the money to keep it up. And that's one of the reasons we see the Acela Express problem. And it's another one of the reasons that we see the dramatic deterioration of the Northeast Corridor and the financial problems of Amtrak. So if you've got this corporation, what do? You say, okay, let's keep the corporation and spin off the train operations into one group, spin off the infrastructure into another group, and then begin to contract out the train operations, so you can do what we were talking about, which is have an incentive for management to be able to do something.
Okay, and what would Amtrak do in that list?
Well, Amtrak would be the train operating company. The idea was to of the Amtrak Reform Council and the Bush administration is to spin off the infrastructure to the responsibility of the northeastern states. It would still have a substantial input of federal money, but it would basically be an infrastructure facility that served those nine states.
Okay.
Amtrak's role would be to run the trains, but gradually they would have to compete with other firms to bid for the right to continue running various packages of train services.
But, Professor Sklar, if I can just turn to you there, Amtrak is much more than that Northeast Corridor. What do you make of this idea that Mr. Till is expanding on here?
Well, the first thing is Mr. Till forgot to mention is that after British Rail separated the rails from the rolling stock, the private company they set up to run the rails went bankrupt and had to be taken back into public receivership. And so it's once again a public operation to maintain the rail bed. The private sector wasn't able to do it. And it's not that the private sector can't do it. It's a problem. You have to put the problem in its historic context. So the issue of the rail beds is key to the whole thing. Most of the rail beds in this country, with the exception of the Northeast Corridor, are privately run, and they're run by the freight companies.
Mm-hmm.
Freight has always been the profitable side of the rail business. Passenger rail has never been the profitable side of the business.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to talk about systems, nobody owns the highway system. If we talk about what Britain has is the British public own the rail system, and then they do lease out the rolling stock, and they have train operating companies that then run it. And you can do it that way if you want. You can talk about competition. The problem is that the natural monopoly in this is the rail bed, and that's the key. And to separate the wheels from the tracks, it's intellectually possible, but the reality is that increasingly the rail operator and the British government increasingly regulate the companies, so that what they're moving towards is they're reinventing Amtrak over in Britain at a higher cost. And I have no problem with that if it puts more money into the system, but the notion that the market's going to solve this thing is absurd.
Mr. Till, here's a question for a free market, someone from a free market think tank. Is it just necessarily going to have to be a monopoly because of this rail bed issue that Professor Sklar is bringing up?
I think in this respect, Elliot is right, and that is that you've got a monopoly with regard to the ownership of the track, and that's what has been recommended for the ownership of the track between Washington and Boston. It's just that it shouldn't be the monopoly operator of the passenger service at the same time. And the fact of the matter is that in Britain, one of the reasons a rail track went bust was because of the way they implemented it. I think the concept was right, and it's not just in Britain. Britain was actually following a basic design that was implemented by the European Union. In 1991, they put out an EU directive called 91440, And 91440 says we're going to move toward a different regime for providing rail service because rail service is too expensive and too distant from the marketplace, whether it's the passenger marketplace or the freight marketplace, to serve us well in the European Union. So they said we're going to split the infrastructure off into a separate company. Some countries have done it with more relish and others with less. We're going to gradually introduce competition into the provision of passenger rail service, and we're going to do the same thing eventually with the provision of passenger freight service.
I'm sorry, with
international freight service.
I'm going to stop you there because I'd like to get some callers in on this conversation, and we have a phone bank piling up. We have a call here from Carthage, North Carolina. Charles, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
You have a comment about Amtrak?
Well, yes. My wife and I we're conservative Republicans. We voted for George Bush, but we really think that he's wrong in this respect. I think that we really need a state-of-the-art rail service in America. I don't think that that's Amtrak, though. We just recently wrote it, and I think what we were told when we wrote it was that it is the rail bed issue. And just like there are subsidies for the highways, I think that we ought to have subsidies for an efficient rail service in America.
What was the matter with it when you wrote it, Charles?
Well, it was 2.5 hours late, and the reason is because we were going to Florida, and supposedly it shares the line with freight companies, and it has to move over onto siding every time a freight train goes by. So we actually missed the train coming back, and I had to take off an extra day of work because they told us it was more than 3 hours late and we could go get something to eat or do something. And when we came back, it had only been an hour and a half late, and we missed it by 30 minutes.
What a great day, Charles. Well, why, despite all of that, are you keen on keeping passenger rail service, not necessarily Amtrak?
Well, I think my daughters have traveled in Europe. They thought that, that's the envy. They just couldn't believe what they have there. And no matter how we slice it, the days of the automobile are doomed. Hydrogen fuel cells aren't going to do it for the future. We're going to have to find a lot more efficient ways to get people around. And I thought we lost a big opportunity when we laid off a lot of aerospace engineers and stuff. That would have been a great time for the government to pour some money in to make a state-of-the-art rail service. To do that kind of thing, I think it just takes some government initiative to look into the future and make those hard decisions, despite the vagaries of day-to-day democracy.
Right, of our fortunes, Professor Sklar. What's your reaction to Charles's very bad day? This whole sharing the track thing. Some of these things are out of Amtrak's control, but it isn't always the best managed system.
Well, no, I've had those days too. So I do know that, and part of the problem is as you correctly said, that being moved on to sidings. Because what happened when Amtrak took the passenger rail service off of the freight rail companies, the deal they were given, and this is an issue that they're going to have to deal with if going forward on these organizations. The deal that Amtrak got was it would be allowed to use those tracks at marginal cost. The problem is, the freight companies give first priority to the freight trains and not to the passenger rail trains, which they basically almost are giving right of way to. So one of the issues that has to be resolved, if we're going to have a system, is this question of a national rail bed system that can work at a very high level of performance. And the other thing that Charles said that I would pick up on is the government has to get into the act, because all the high speed trains in Europe, they were all government initiatives. They weren't private sector initiatives, and they can't be, because the private sector there's a huge high degree of speculativeness to it in getting these things started. There's little chance of return of profit, and public-private partnerships have to be the kinds of things that are done. And I agree with what Thomas said before. It isn't about privatization. And I have I have no problem with having competing trains run on it, but you only got one track between two cities.
Yeah.
And the real question becomes, you know, how much volume, you know, how much excess capacity you want to load onto those systems. So
okay, you're somewhat limited in your options there.
It's going to be a regulated system, no matter how you do it, and that doesn't mean it can't be done efficiently, and there can't be accountability, and that Amtrak doesn't have bloat, and there aren't ways to fix it.
Right. Okay. But, I'm going to stop you there. You're listening to On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway. I'd like to bring another guest into the conversation. Frank Wilner is joining us from Alexandria, Virginia. He spent 30 years with the railways. He's the former chief of staff at the Surface Transportation Board under President Clinton. And he's also the author of The Amtrak Story. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Wilner.
Thank you.
Can you take us back to the beginning here? I want to get a sense of how Amtrak came to be. Why did we start a publicly funded passenger rail service?
Because the freight railroads that had been operating passenger trains were losing $750 million a year. That was in 1958, one of the first studies done. That translates to about $5 billion, B as in boy, $5 billion in losses today. It would certainly bankrupt the freight railroads. But the American people wanted a national intercity rail passenger network. They made that clear to the politicians. And there was a contract that was formed. The railroads wanted to give up the money-losing passenger service. American people wanted a passenger service. So in exchange for the government taking it over, the freight railroads promised they would give priority access to the passenger trains. The problem was, almost as soon as Amtrak was formed, the conservatives in government said, subsidies are bad, we want to end these subsidies. The Nixon administration hoped that Amtrak would go away in 2 or 3 years. It called it an experiment. But lo and behold, Americans wanted to ride the trains, and they did ride the trains. And the Nixon administration was unable to do so.
Well, tell me about the role the big three automakers played in the ability of passenger rail to grow.
Oh, I think there are a lot of myths attached to saying that the automakers are responsible for this. I mean, for the most part, Americans do want to drive their cars. It's probably the greatest invention in the history of mankind, automobiles giving people freedom to travel. But what passenger rail does is it removes or helps to remove some of the congestion from the highways, some of the congestion from the aviation system. And as the American population ages, there's a greater desire to have a passenger rail. Now, we run into what is called political reality. We can make a lot of these arguments in a civics class and say, well, or an economics class and say we should just focus on the highly dense, the dense passenger corridors in the United States, such as Boston to New York, Washington to New York, San Diego to Los Angeles. But the political reality is that if you're going to have subsidies, you have to have political support nationwide.
Right.
Now, it may be absurd to economists, it may be absurd to others, but that's the political reality, and we have to have a broadly supported national intercity rail passenger network, and that's what Amtrak is all about.
Now, the Bush administration is talking tough on Amtrak, but is this the most hostile administration Amtrak has faced?
The toughest talk came from the greatest communicator of the 20th century, Ronald Reagan. And he wasn't able to kill Amtrak. Remember the Greek mythological figure Sisyphus. Sisyphus was consigned to roll a boulder up a hill his entire eternity.
Forever, not just his life.
Forever and ever. And of course, as Sisyphus got closer to the top with the boulder, it would roll back down again, and he had to start all over again. And Amtrak's first president said it in a different way, through religious terminology. Roger Lewis, who was the first Amtrak president, said, if you think the Lord Jesus had problems, you should see Amtrak management going up the hill with the crosses on our backs. Since its inception, Amtrak has had these problems. Ronald Reagan trotted out his budget director, David Stockman, who in front of White House photographers had on a conductor's cap, a change, coin changer, and he clicked out 700 nickels to demonstrate the subsidy that went to every Amtrak passenger. Of course, they ignored the tremendous subsidies that go to automobile operators and to aviation.
Right. Mr. Wilner, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Frank Wilner joined us from Alexandria, Virginia. He spent 30 years with the railways. He's the former chief of staff at the Surface Transportation Board under President Clinton. We're discussing the future of Amtrak and passenger rail service in America. You can join the conversation. Is it time for entrepreneurs to risk their money on Amtrak? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support for On. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Amtrak's future on the rails. You can join the conversation. Nostalgia aside, what do you think America will lose? What will you lose if Amtrak goes? Are you an enthusiast, or did you give up on Amtrak long ago? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're speaking with Elliot Sklar, professor of urban planning and public affairs at Columbia University and the author of Amtrak Privatization, The Route to Failure. And we're speaking with Thomas Till. He's former executive director of the Amtrak Reform Council. He's currently managing director of the Discovery Institute, a free market think tank. I'd like to go back to the phones now. We have a call from Waterton, Massachusetts. Nino, welcome to On Point.
Hello. It's an interesting conversation. I'm enjoying it, but I think it's way too technical.
Okay.
I think that it's interesting, but too technical. I think the whole question should be, is having the rail service in the public interest, and is it for common good? That question is kind of disappearing from American politics, and it seems that the only thing we are thinking about is what is making profit and what is not. And if the public decides, citizens decide that it is, and that having a high-tech, state-of-the-art rail service is something that citizens would want, federal government, which is obviously financed from the taxes paid by these same citizens, will have to find money to finance it.
Nino, do you ride trains yourself?
I obviously live near Boston, and I enjoy really train rides to New York. It's sometimes late, but so are the airplanes also, and so I've been stuck on the road quite a few times also.
That's a fair point. We've all had delays wherever we'd wanted to be. Mr. Till, I'd like to put that less technical question, Nino's a man after my own heart, to you. Isn't this a sort of a bigger moral question or a philosophical question for us?
Well, you know, I think there's no doubt that a proper program of rail passenger service is in the public interest, and it can be for the common good. There's no doubt about that. And one reason that Amtrak has survived, despite all of its difficulties, is that there is an understanding that somewhere underneath all this, there is a program that makes sense, or there should be a program that makes sense. And I think our question is, how do we structure this thing so it will run well enough so that passengers like our prior caller would actually enjoy the service? I mean, if you've looked at stories recently, you will find a story of a couple of weeks ago under obviously the much better management that David Gunn is providing, and I'm very serious about that, spent 5 hours isolated on a train in South Carolina where they had to call the local first responders to get off the train because the crew was not helping them, and so the service was miserable, and that's not what we need. We need something that's going to work, and within that framework, we need something that's not directly hotwired to the Congress like Amtrak is. If you are able to put it on a federal-state basis, if you allow competition in, and if these people are operating on a contract, if they don't provide good service, they get booted. They've had contractors fired from their franchises in Great Britain because they didn't meet the service quality that they were supposed to provide.
We have a caller.
I think that's a big part of it.
We have a caller here who's a former employee of Amtrak. This call coming from Minocqua, Wisconsin. Susie, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
You have a comment you'd like to make.
Yes, my first comment is that Amtrak should be disbanded. It is the worst single company in management that I have ever worked for. But I'd like the gentleman to comment on the unionization. Yes, all the things that they're talking about are true. The roadbeds aren't in the control of Amtrak. Many, many people love the experience of trains, but they're one of the most expensive of any kinds of transportation to try to keep up because of the rolling stock, the roadbeds. But there's also, when I worked for them 6 years ago, there were 13 unions, the most unionized of any transportation system in the U.S., as I understand. And you haven't spoken to that, and I think that that is a huge cost as well.
Okay, can I ask you a question there, Susie, before you go? You said right off the top you thought it was one of the worst managed companies out there. Why do you say that?
I had a bigger budget for Amtrak in marketing than I'd ever had for companies like Hyatt and Marriott. The controls on the company are not there, and each of the trains has their own management that usually has a regional interest that's different from the national interest, and so more time is spent in meetings than I've also ever seen in any company.
Okay. I'm going to turn this over to Professor Sklar. What do you say to Susie?
Well, I was struck. I guess I'm trying to understand. Is she saying that because they're unionized, they're badly managed, or is she saying because they're union? I don't understand.
Well, Susie was saying a couple things there. She doesn't think that Amtrak is well managed, and she also thinks it's dealing with way too many unions.
So she wants union consolidation, or the existence. It seems to me there's an issue of the cost of operation, and oftentimes when people point to unions, the argument that they're making is that unions make wages too high, and they make and because of the work rules that they engage in, it becomes a less efficient system. That would be the impute her argument. I would assume that was the shorthand. That's what she was saying.
Well, it's really hard to spin on a dime and make quick responses to your market needs and whatnot when you're dealing with 13 strong unions. I mean, is that not fair?
Well, once again, do the 13 unions have to do with? It seems to me the marketing has to do with management.
Yeah, this is a big issue for the Amtrak Reform Council, and I think we could shed a little light on that because mm-hmm. it's very interesting, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead, Mr. Ted.
And the issue is this: there are two levels of the issue. One level of the issue is the structure of 19th century industrial unions, which, together with the structure of 19th century industrial management, have had a tremendous negative impact on a lot of our basic industries, like our maritime industry, like our railroad industry, like our steel industry. And I'm not cast putting all the blame on the union side. There have been plenty of blame to hand to the management side, and that's one of the endemic problems of the railroad industry. Now, when you take that particular problem and you hotwire that agency to the Congress, where labor unions have a major influence, then you make it even more difficult for management, whether it's particularly even a good management, to deal effectively with the unions. So if they're getting all their money from the Congress, and the Congress and the unions help them get that money, it's very hard for them to negotiate at arm's length. And that's one thing that separating these operating contracts from the congressional tie would actually do.
Okay, I want to go back to the phones again from Burlington, North Carolina. Gray, do you have a comment
to
make?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you have a comment to make to our guests?
Yes, I just wanted to make the comment that the previous callers are completely right that this goes beyond a company question as far as Amtrak, but it does go to a national rail system and a desire for that. But also, as has been stated before, there is no system in this world that makes money hauling passengers. They're all subsidized in one way or the other, and that's for transportation, period, not just rail. Roads, airlines, maritime systems, everything has some sort of transportation subsidy to it.
I guess the question becomes, Gray, how much you're willing to pay as a taxpayer. Amtrak is asking for a 50% increase in its budget next year. And does this reach a point for you where it's not worth it, or are you willing to pay a pretty steep price to be able to still take a train?
How much is 50%?
Well, according to this, isn't it $1.8 billion they're asking for?
$1.8 billion. We just voted $81 billion. The sums are trivial.
This is you, Professor Sklar?
Yes.
Okay. We just voted how many for what?
Basically, the emergency appropriation for the war in Afghanistan,
okay.
$81 billion. We spent, I mean, the notion of it being 50% blows that out of the water and makes it sound like something huge. It's a pittance compared to what we spend on highways, to what we spend on the air system. And the issue I'd like to segue back to is this issue that somehow the unions control, the railroad unions control the Congress. I think that's nonsense. I think that, you know, if you look at the bill, that there are lobbyists that control the Congress. It's a huge political economy of them. And as far as I can tell from the papers, you know, they basically give massive campaign contributions. The railroad unions are trivial in this, but what it does is it changes this whole debate from what we should be talking about, which is how do we have an efficient passenger rail system.
Okay, I'd like to bring in another caller here from Marshfield, Massachusetts. Steve, welcome to On Point. Do you have a comment to make?
Yes, I do. Thank you for taking the call. I have direct experience with the British privatization process.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the UK in 2002. I was at a station, and I wanted to find the next train to go to the next station down the line. Three different passenger companies. No one could tell me when the next train to the next station was. I tried to call a national transportation timetable service, and, of course, everyone was having the same problem. You couldn't get through. Finally, that train came along, and I was able to get there. If you break up, you're going to triple the overhead. The more you break up the system, and there are economies of scale by keeping it a unified national system, which we need. And there, and when you come to track maintenance, that is that you have to be aware of the specific history of the maintenance of the local territory. If you privatize that, you're going to bring in contractor A for this year who doesn't know what's been done in the past. Next year, contractor C is going to come in. They're not going to know the history of the maintenance of that line. And because track relates to the geography, the landscape, you need some continuity of management. And if you want to have the track maintenance connect and serve to the trains that are going to operate, you need the operators to be part of the same system as the maintainers. It's common sense.
Okay, Steve, thank you so much for that. And thank you to our guests for joining us this evening. Professor Elliot Sklar, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
From Larchmont, New York, Professor Sklar is professor of urban planning and public affairs at Columbia University. He's also the author of Amtrak Privatization, The Route to Failure. And thank you, Thomas Till, for joining us tonight.
Welcome.
He came to us from Seattle, Washington. Thomas Till is the former executive director of the Amtrak Reform Council. He was also in the Reagan administration, where he was deputy federal railroad administrator. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Jennifer Westaway. This is On Point. Late this afternoon, Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th terrorist behind the attacks of 9/11, pleaded guilty to all six counts of conspiracy against him. This afternoon, United States Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez announced the conviction.
Just a short while ago at the federal courthouse in Alexandria, Virginia, Zacharias Moussaoui pled guilty to charges related to his role in the conspiracy that brought about the September 11th terrorist attacks. Four of these charges authorize a maximum penalty of death. And as you know, we are seeking the death penalty in this case.
Moussaoui, a French citizen of Moroccan descent, is the only person charged in the United States in connection with the September 11th attacks. He was arrested a month before 9/11 after raising suspicions at a Minnesota flight school when he showed up with $7,000 in cash for training on a Boeing 747 flight simulator. The case now moves into penalty phase. For the latest on the Moussaoui case and today's guilty plea, we go to Josh Meyer in Washington. He covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, Jennifer.
This kind of caught me by surprise. Maybe it shouldn't have. It's been in the courts for a while. What brought about today's guilty plea?
Well, I mean, nothing surprises me about the Massawi case anymore. I mean, this has been going on for about 3.5 years now. But apparently Massawi, to everyone's surprise, a while back decided that he wanted to plead guilty and plead guilty only with the stipulation that they not charge him with the death penalty. And by that I mean that he essentially accepted the fact that they would try to put him to death if convicted.
Okay, so that was the trade-off for him. He's been a little combative in his relationships in the court case for that couple of years, hasn't he?
Yeah, he certainly has. I was at the first a hearing where at one point he sort of pointed his finger skyward and we thought he was pointing at something and he was actually asking for the judge's attention. And he went on a 45-minute tirade about the United States and Al-Qaeda and so on and so forth. And we were just stunned in the courtroom. But it's sort of been a roller coaster ride ever since. He's written hundreds of letters, many of them very long, very articulate letters, many of them very angry. But nobody can really tell what he's going to do from one minute to the next.
Remind us exactly what is it that he's pled guilty to?
Well, it's all very complicated, but essentially he pleaded guilty to playing a role in a terrorist conspiracy that includes the September 11th, 2001 attacks. It's not exactly clear exactly what they think he did in that plot. For instance, even in the stipulation today, a five-page stipulation to what he agreed to, it's not clear if he was going to be one of the hijackers in the September 11th plot or if he was going to be part of a second wave of hijackers.
Right.
Or so on. I mean, we were really hoping for a trial so we could hear some of that information that the government has. It may come out the capital phase of the sentencing.
Well, did we get some new information today about his connections to Al-Qaeda? Was he claiming he was going to fly a plane into the White House? Did that come out in court?
Well, there were sort of tidbits here and there today that came out that were new, and by now there's been so much written about this that it's hard to figure out what's new, what's not, and what's simply significant in that it corroborates what we thought was new, but we weren't sure, if that makes any sense. But for instance, the thing about the White House, that actually has been out there before. I mean, Bin Laden apparently had wanted the fourth plane that didn't make it, that crashed in Pennsylvania, to be flown into the White House, and apparently
right.
he gave Massawi and others the blessing to do that. But Muhammad Atta, who was the emir or the operational commander of the September 11th plot, thought that the White House was too small of a target to hit or too hard, and so he opted for the Capitol. So nobody's really sure exactly where that plane would have tried to go once it got here.
And just briefly, Josh, in these few remaining seconds here that we have, is there a next step now? Are there other cases in the works relating to 9/11?
Well, certainly there's a case in Spain right now where they're trying,
yes.
I guess it's like about a dozen people. In the United States, as far as we can tell, no. I mean, that's one of the big mysteries is who else certainly participated in the plot, who is out there, who may or may not have been charged, how many people are trying to be, the U.S. government's trying to extradite to the United States to charge them, how many are in secret custody and awaiting military tribunals. There's a lot of, it's all up in the air right now.
Okay. Well, Josh, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Washington. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for On Point.